I should be getting that in terms of a family background.
Because that's important.
But
I was certainly programmed. I didn't have any choice. I was a third generation expected to go to college, and I wanted to go to college. Really, not much question about it. But the tradition of the family, expectations are, your ancestors put down, guide you along. My brothers were even more influenced.
Yeah, they were
very smart.
Uh-huh.
They were capable, and I just had to do as well as I could.
Maybe I couldn't watch them, but I had to do the best I could.
Well, I'm sure you did damn well. I mean,
yeah.
you got through the coursework, and
and going on.
But
I was thinking that my own father
was the.
Well, my grandparents were immigrants.
Uh-huh.
And to just
make a go of it.
Uh-huh. So the first person in my family to go on to college at all was my father.
Uh-huh. He was the first one
in his family to graduate
from high school.
Where you
they
on?
Were they were originally from Sweden. And
at least
by the time my father and his siblings were born, they were in Chicago.
They probably knocked around a little bit before getting there.
But so my dad graduated from high school sometime in the early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if it was 22 or 23. And
what year was he born?
03.
Oh, three. Oh, he's older than my father.
Oh, yeah.
07, yeah.
Yeah. And
he must have some considerably older brothers.
No, I'm the oldest.
Really?
What happened was
late. I was 35 when my father was 37. My father was 37 when I was born.
Yeah, my dad was a bit older. Plus having the other years too.
Yeah.
Let's see, how did it go? He was out of school. Really thinking it was 22 when he graduated. Let's see, that's too young. He had to have been 1923, maybe.
He was born in 03, he would have been 18 in 1921.
He was either 18 or 19. He probably didn't go through as quickly as he should have, with all the family stuff. Worked for a while. And, with a high school degree, you could go up a lot further than we can now. So it was actually choosing the wrong place to go. He went into the stock market in Chicago. And was actually starting to go to Northwestern at night, when the stock market crash hit. And then they kept him on for a few years.
Uh-huh.
But eventually they had to let him go.
Mm.
This is while he was burying... first his father, and then later, when they let him go, he had enough money saved up still to buy a small farm in Michigan. So took his older brother who was dying of cancer, and his mother who was dying of cancer. Of tuberculosis, both cases. My uncle was dying of tuberculosis. My grandmother was dying of cancer. And another brother and a sister, and then buried the two that were dying, and then eventually moved back to Chicago, then met my mother, but for financial reasons couldn't marry until after World War II was over.
Mm-hmm.
Although he didn't serve because of physical things with his ears and some other stuff. So anyway, but this isn't about me.
Yeah.
But it's kind of an odyssey because then later, when I was growing up, there was no question, because my mother had gone to nursing school.
Mm-hmm.
My dad had gone to college, but couldn't complete,
but
knew that he had to go, and that his son was going to have to go. There was just no choice. I mean, this is just like, there was not even a consideration of any other kind of alternative for me, So I just went. Just like sheep, Just go into it and saying, why am I here, God. But anyway... let's see, I'm going to talk into this and just to say that Sabina is now off to her meeting, and it's now about 11:25, and Steve has filled the chair, and so we're going to pick up with him, so he's going to have to try and compete and do better, or at least match his wife. But I did want to to start off with the family things about this is a Swedish cup?
Swedish coat of arms.
Yeah. Oh, is that the family origin?
No. I think my daughter visited there Filipino dance tour.
Oh, okay. All right, and then picked it up.
Yeah,
actually
she went to Norway. I'm not sure how she got the Sweden thing there. Maybe my wife picked up somewhere. But...
Okay, so this is not your family background?
No, English.
Oh, okay, all right.
Waspy.
Okay, all right. Well, no, it's my parents and grandparents and such, from actually both sides of the family. Mm-hmm. So it's like I never left the old world. I just kept on intermarrying. But, what your parents did and occupationally and all that, and a little bit about yourself to get up to the why you joined kind of background.
Basically, I had a very good growing up.
Amherst, Mass.
And actually, I was in Sharon, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Which is about 20 miles southwest of Boston. Went to private school for 3 grades, 5th, 6th, and 7th. Came back to public school and graduated from public high school. Lived in a beautiful house. I'll never live in such a nice house again. Everything was paid for along the way. My parents said that they had as many children as they could support up through the end of college. It was just,
And that was going to be it.
That was going to be it. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I might add, they've been supportive all the way along. When I was in Vietnam, for example, I needed something. They'd say, well, what can I get you? And he'd go out and send materials that would be books or inner uterine devices or any number of things. So, he had a very clear idea of what it meant to have a family and what it meant to be a father, and he was a master of both, and I'm grateful. And he left for me a model, a sacred model, have a family and give it your all. That's what you do. My dad is, went to MIT, was an engineer through his working life. Was in World War II as an engineer, a little too old for combat.
Uh-huh.
My mother graduated from Wellesley in biology, worked as a lab assistant for a while, got married, and then did what was common then. You were simply a mother and homemaker for the rest of your life.
Yeah, my mother never went back to the nursing full time. Mm-hmm. She did a little part time. But,
With that kind of background, it was a yeasty mix at home. At the dinner table, we discussed engineering problems or science fair projects. My mother read voluminously and would share. We didn't use the word cultivate in mind, but that was kind of what was expected. My two brothers are considerably older than I am. One went to Haverford and then to MIT. The other went to Swarthmore.
Haverford College, okay.
And then to University of Pennsylvania for his PhD. So these guys are bright. They worked hard. They achieved in school. They both became academics. A professor at UMass, a professor at the University of Alaska.
Ah.
And in their adult lives, they're multidimensional. They do civic work, they follow politics. They did a lot of things with their kids and scouts and skiing, sports of different kind. And their kids are off doing very interesting things right now. They follow the model of being totally involved with your family. That's your sacred duty. And they've gone beyond my parents, as I said, in doing community things, particularly my brother in Massachusetts. He's designing pathways for bicycles. He's handles election night data and computer programs. For many years, he was in Boy Scouts. He's in charge of the Pioneer Valley Transit Authority, finances, finding corruption there. He can keep a lot of balls in the air.
Yeah.
And,
it sounds like you actually...
He contributes a great deal.
You do a lot, too. I mean, you talk about civic action. You go off to IVS for life. And
that's true. That was my, as I said, my formative experience.
But even now, you take kids off to... international trips to China and stuff like
that. When you're a teacher, it is all-consuming, and it involves things like that. It's far.
So it's constant service.
Constant service. I guess you could put that spin on. Although I look forward to doing things outside of school.
Always envisioned as the professor's life was to give the lecture, go back to the office, sit around for the hour, take off, and write great things. And I found that I'm I stay all day. I meet with students intermittently throughout that day.
Uh-huh.
Meet with faculty on projects mm-hmm. at the other times.
Mm-hmm.
And have almost no writing time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in our little break here, I was looking over a paper as part of the junior research project. And you have a committee of, you have three students who uh-huh. are your advisees, and I'm one of their three readers on a little committee, kind of like a junior, like a senior in university thesis project,
mm-hmm.
advisors, and your paper scrutinized, and they have to present this week. So that's just one of the things that come along to
yeah.
absorb your time beyond getting stuff ready for the classes.
Oh, yeah. Getting stuff ready for the classes is not exactly a breeze, but it's not that hard.
Yeah.
But it's looking over that kid's paper so that they really do well and can feel proud.
I have one student who's just struggling everything from verb subject agreement to which I had to present first. I'm simply kind of going through outlining.
Yeah.
And kind of, I can't teach by simply explaining. I have to go ahead and try to model an essay. And I'm supposed to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Be in hers entirely originally, but if she can learn how to input the ideas for to achieve maximum emphasis, how to write transitions and good topic sense and all that stuff.
Should be light years ahead of a lot of students.
Yeah.
That's because a lot of them, I can tell you, they don't know it by the time they hit college.
Mm-hmm.
So
going back to kind of growing up, as I mentioned to you at the fellowship, I can remember in high school, Kennedy and Peace Corps, the idea kind of stood behind me. I remember thinking about teaching, even as a high school student. I loved biology, and I would teach biology. And it turns out I did briefly. But when I got to Earlham College, it was a Quaker campus, very liberal.
Where is Earlham?
It's in Richmond, Indiana, on Route 40, which is right middle of the state, north-south. Go straight west to Indianapolis, straight east to Dayton.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was a very conservative community, but inside there was a another community, very liberal.
Yeah.
And I should send them some money by way of donation. They help shape me. I just don't have it.
Do they send you all the time?
Oh, constantly. They've been very loyal and send them information.
I think my schools have wasted more money on postage to me than I'm ever going to be able to give back.
Really, really. But Earlham gave the atmosphere which to not do the necessary national thing. Okay, to kind of. Gave me the background to dissent in some small way.
Mm-hmm.
And the school itself had studies abroad, so kids were going off to Italy, going to Japan, and coming back. A lot of kids at that time were doing civil rights work. They would go down south.
At that time, what years?
This is 62 to 66. And
62,
of course,
66,
that was all
okay.
The Martin Luther King, the civil rights
era. Yeah.
Of course, he started getting involved in Vietnam during that time.
But if 62, that's even a little bit earlier than many other students might have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So your campus was probably kind of mm-hmm. at the cutting edge,
right.
Sort of.
And then people were doing volunteer work with young friends groups.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a couple weekends going to Ohio, one time up to Michigan, Ann Arbor, I believe. And did some sort of.
Was your family Quaker?
It's Quaker in that they told Quaker stories and they had. Grandfathers and uncles who were called heavy Quakers, and if you go down to West Falmouth, Massachusetts, where I'll be going this summer, where we all came from, there's a Quaker meeting house around there. In headstones is a whole genealogy. Just go
really?
Back.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all
yeah.
concentrated there. And we all went to Quaker schools.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, my two brothers graduated from Moses Brown. That's where I went for those 5th, 6th, and 7th grade. Hereford, Swarthmore, Earlham, all Quaker College. That's kind of by the kind of school that were more than the need to have a Quaker background. But we were comfortable. It wasn't strange to go there.
Yeah, but it wasn't. But you weren't going there to see that. Planes are getting low. We're being buzzed here.
Uh-huh.
But you weren't going to the Quaker school because it was decided that it was important to go to a school where your religion is from.
No, I went there because they had a good biology department. I went there because it's a little far away from home.
Yeah,
I went there because
you want to get away.
I had visited there in the summertime in a great swing through the Middle West and had just met people in the town of Richmond who were friendly where they didn't have to be, and mm-hmm. met people on campus who were accommodating, friendly, helpful, more than they had to be. Mm-hmm. Just
and genuinely.
Environment. Genuinely so.
The yeah, not trying to get another student because here's some more tuition.
Yeah.
The we got to stay solvent.
Had read that I played tennis, and he said, gee, it was a nice interview. Well, you got some time? You happen to bring a racket along? And so he went out and he played tennis. And I went to the biology building and just ran into students there. And it was like that all the way along. Okay, uh-huh. Talk about community. And it was as real as you could expect.
Yeah.
You knew everybody, and you had people you were close with all through, well, I'm sure like many college situations, but...
Not in the big state schools.
Yeah.
No, we can't do that. You know?
And we saw...
We try, but, you know...
We had, people from the Civil Rights Movement through. We never had Martin Luther King. We had various groups come through, and they perform and raise money, go down. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, some of our students went down and were involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And also in the Richmond area. There were some sit-ins in Richmond area. We had one student was one of the ones who integrated the schools in Little Rock, Arkansas, came to Earlham.
Really?
He was with McCorkle.
Uh-huh.
Helped. Governor Faber stood there, and the National Guard was there, and she was one who was let in.
You mean the little girl?
Yeah.
She was?
Black girl. At Earlham College in my class.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I've heard recently how once she was actually in, they had to have a special teacher just for her.
Mm-hmm.
And a classroom that was
no other
students, and then there was all these other kids in the next room, and she always kind of heard voices,
sure,
and but she was never let in.
She was tough, and
to have been tough.
We had something Apotheker,
Herbert Apotheker,
who was the Communist Party member.
Right.
Because
it was Herbert who was his father, or something like that. Or something.
It might have been the Herbert Apotheker who came there.
Okay.
He was old on in years. And then we had George Wallace. And so we had these streams of current Americana coming right through. Very nurturing.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me out of my laboratory occasionally. And it,
and especially a small campus. You wouldn't have the community of the science people in isolation from the social sciences and from the liberal arts.
Right.
They'd all be...
Absolutely.
Flowing around together.
You met in your hall, in your bull sessions, from one stall to the next stall in the restroom, you have, what's going on political science? Oh, man, I got this paper. Of course, the liberal arts, and so you had to take things from, across the branches of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, too often at the bigger schools, you don't have to do that. You can
quickly
get off into a cubby hall.
I resented that at the time.
What, resented all the mixture?
Yeah, I wanted to stay in the science building. I was happy there.
Uh-huh.
And I must admit, I kind of scorned those who weren't doing, real solid work.
Uh-huh.
Vietnam showed me how important other things were.
Mm.
And so I came back, and I basically abandoned science. I got into anthropology and language and took a lot of writing, which I scorned, and got killed at. I couldn't do a good research paper at all. And politics and so on, so... Earlham, and then backed up by the Vietnam experience, opened my mind to be an understatement, made me kind of a Renaissance person in attitude, if not in accomplishment.
Hey, how many Michelangelos can there be?
Yeah,
thank God there's some of us to clean up the streets.
Yeah,
yeah. But why, I think you mentioned this when we were having lunch, but why the IVS?
Well,
you said somebody was coming through, and there was the class dismissed. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's not on tape. I know.
Sure. It's Professor. Let me get the gentleman's name. His name will come back. Chemistry professor, a dear man at Earlham, announced one day that a gentleman from IVS would be coming through campus. It was an opportunity to kind of. Get out of our campus a little bit, in their minds anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure in the back
like
of his mind,
of
he was a
speakers.
Good Quaker.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that Quakers should consider some sort of alternative service. I'm not sure in the connection of the war, maybe. But broke off his lecture in Resonance and Aromaticity and had this gentleman come in. And it was Willie Myers, whom I met later in orientation and who I met several times in Vietnam. He's now, I believe, University of Minnesota, very bright guy, went on to get his PhD in agricultural economics. And he told a story, and it was fascinating. And at about the same time, I've been, you know, talking with all manner of people. It was, it was the guys, you know, we knew that the draft was coming down on us. And we knew we couldn't go out and just find ourselves when it was all over. We had to have something. It was going to be medical school, dental school, graduate school, or some sort of volunteer service. And it turns out 10% of ours...
I think I can start now. And so you were breaking off and saying about how 10% of your class went into IVS and Peace Corps and VISTA. You said something else.
And the
VISA?
VISA.
What is that? I hadn't heard of that.
Volunteers in Service to America. That's VISTA.
Yeah.
Hold off on VISA. Maybe there's a distinction here. I can't bring it back now.
Okay.
And
then I'd never heard
American,
of it.
Their American Friends Service had their had people going abroad.
Oh, okay.
I met them in the hospital in Quang Ngai, for example, where they're working on prostheses for those war amputees.
Sabina anyway, mentioned that hospital, too.
So the good chemistry professor inviting the speaker in on IVS, the pressure to have something to do, the tradition of volunteer service at Earlham, plus... just some very simple, though, original thinking on my part. How could we as a country, under the direction of Johnson, who's sitting in Washington, know enough to make life and death decisions on a huge magnitude in a place so far away we knew that we could not know very much about it?
This was even before you joined IVS?
Before I joined IVS.
Oh, okay.
So it just seemed stupid, absurd on the face of it.
Okay, because I had the impression that you came to this after being in Vietnam for a while. But
what I did understand after I was in Vietnam a while was the specifics of our iniquitous involvement in Vietnam.
Okay.
Okay. And that what I thought were sort of knee-jerk liberals had said on campus about, okay, you know, there is the people who the French fought, people who supported the French in Vietnam, kind of scratch that. The people who, the French had tried to go back in to reopen their colonial regime.
Mm-hmm.
The collaborators they had were, in often cases, Catholic, and basically had, and the views of the Vietnamese had turned their back on their own country people.
Yeah. Okay?
That these people, not only being Catholic, but were sort of upper class, kind of a comforter class, and were not really wholesome types who was in our national tradition of helping colonies be freed from the motherland. Okay, we were supporting colonial regime, basically.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the war was, the French lost the war. There's an agreement to schedule in 2 years in 56 an election. The United States came in with not only backed the French in their losing effort, but came in after the French left and found Ngo Dinh Diem. And he was a North Vietnamese Catholic, maybe Central Vietnamese from Hanoi. He was a Catholic, you know, familiar to us. He was horribly corrupt. In other words, they had the details of the political situation down, they had history down and so on. And I kind of thought that was just kind of nitpicking and something they didn't know very well, because how could they hadn't been there themselves yet. Never mind.
Right,
Johnson had
right.
been there.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like a kind of just another page out of their liberal code book and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got there, okay, I realized that, you know, their information was very correct, their analysis was correct, and I was envious that they had done enough homework to have that kind of background, even if they had done it out of context, sort of away from it, out of, if you will, kind of a family background.
Yeah.
But
some of the details wrong, but the mainstream was...
Yeah.
Pretty accurate.
I heard the same story from the Vietnamese themselves once I learned enough Vietnamese to be able to have these kind of conversations. And so, belatedly, I take my hat off to those people. Sometimes they went on and on and on and on and on.
Sometimes.
A man who is not given to a lot of conversation. But anyway.
Sometimes there's a holier-than-thou thing that can come through with anyone who's trying to carry on a cause.
I think you're correct, yeah.
You know, and that... That turned me off, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't know if the years match up.
Sanctity.
But about,
sanctimoniousness.
Yeah, but about 66, I think it was, maybe 67, things were getting, I went to state school, Northern Illinois, outside of Chicago, and things were beginning to heat up. Mm. And I went to one particular teach-in where Staunton Lind was coming in from Yale, mm. and our own history department and poli-sci department had, you know, speakers, and there was this teach-in thing. Mm. And I was up in the, in our old administration building, Altguild Hall, had a auditorium in the middle, mm. and it, the ground floor, I was too crowded to get in there, but I went up to a balcony. And there were other people in the balcony who were already the early SDS. Mm. And as soon as the thing got underway, they took this huge Vietnamese, North Vietnamese flag, and just from the back, it sort of pivoted. They were sitting near the front railing of the balcony. They sort of took the flag and then went thump, so that the pole of the flag slammed on the thing. So everyone in the auditorium turned around. And saw this huge North Vietnamese flag hanging over the balcony. It really pissed me off.
Yeah.
It really pissed me off. And, you know, I was going there to find out stuff rather than to be preaching or hear the preaching to the choir, you know.
Yeah.
And because I didn't consider myself in the choir, you know. And it wasn't until people I had known as classmates in different core intro classes began to talk to me that I began to see, well, you know, maybe Jim has learned something. I don't know. You know, it's not just some asshole with an enemy flag who's trying to posture.
Uh-huh.
You know?
The posturing, the sanctimoniousness, the the stridency.
Uh-huh.
That's off-putting.
Yeah, it really is. And they didn't realize how off-putting it was.
Yeah.
You know. Even though I came around perhaps to views as perhaps similar to theirs in many ways, but it took me an awful lot harder
to
come around
to
it.
Yeah, I was behind the curve. And that raises a very interesting story. And over time, you know, I got politicized and I became very cynical about the United States government. And so after I left and the America had, actually I was there in Vietnam when Nixon, the troops went into Cambodia,
uh-huh.
and they come back. But then in 1969, Sihanouk was on vacation. Lol Nol was helped, shall we say, to take over power.
Yeah, we should say that, because no one else does. It just sort of happens. As soon as we want to make an incursion, it just sort of happens, isn't
sure.
that?
And then with him there, there's a sequence of events which I don't understand completely, but the war had been brought to Cambodia, our direct participation there, our manipulation there, and that nurtured the loonies and the Khmer Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
And the Khmer Rouge came to power.
Well, I think it
and
gave...
Here's what happened. I was so politicized and so cynical that I was almost willing to consider the Khmer Rouge in the same light as the Viet Cong, and who were not all that different from a lot of people I had met, but who didn't carry things around and had a label. But they were sort of a well-meaning, skillful, subtle nationalist power. And they had the best interests of the communists in mind. And I thought the United States, in bad-mouthing the Khmer Rouge, we're simply, you know, continuing this stride in any communism and so on, and we're just taking the dunce, you know, bumshan, take the hat of the communists and put it on the heads and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out later I was kind of behind the curve and actually accepting how bad the Khmer Rouge were. I mean, they were nasty, and they're not to be compared to the Viet Cong or the West Indies.
It's incredibly tragic. But let me get some of the chronology straight, because I want to figure out when you were a freshman and when you graduated, when you went to IVS.
Okay, I went to Earlham in September 1962, graduated early June 1966,
uh-huh.
Okay, I was home about 2 weeks. I was down in Washington for orientation for about a week.
After being recruited by Myers?
Right.
Yeah.
I was in the Philippines for 4th of July. Remember celebrating there, 4th of July in the Philippines. Imagine that.
Yeah, and, Philippine Friendship Day.
Right. So it was maybe the middle of July. Okay, we took that plane from Manila to Saigon.
So mid-66?
Mid-66.
And then for how long?
I was there until September 1970.
Okay.
So basically 2 years
plus
a couple months, yeah. Two tours, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And yesterday I was with Frank and Nancy Howarth.
Yeah.
I can never get their pronunciation right. Yeah. They were helping me through a few times. But they described their training program, and it was very much like I was used to in Philippines for Peace Corps. What did you do?
Okay, basically it was, let's go see this and play with it for a while and move on. And we'll hand out some information. Okay, this is in the Philippines at the training center there. I forget the name. You'd have the name. We had classes and we were introduced to animal husbandry and agronomy, rice, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Los Banos. It was like walking through a supermarket. Here's this, and try this, and here's this, and try that.
Because it was for how long?
It was no more than 2 weeks.
No more than 2 weeks, yeah. You
very
can't do very much.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
And we went to Erie, got in the mud, and we tried planting rice, and we saw the harrow, this little comb that they pulled behind
uh-huh,
the top of.
Uh-huh.
We saw the hand water trackers. We saw some pumps, and just kind of basically a quick survey of crops, of tools, of some idea of what was old-fashioned, some idea of what was new.
Uh-huh.
And this is for people in agriculture, people for community development. By that time, I was putting the community development as opposed to, like, you teaching us, we're just going to go and teach science.
Yeah.
It's all the mobile science program, and you have a G4 of equipment you get in school, demonstrations and so on.
You were going to do that for community development?
I was going to do that originally. Then they looked at my background for more, and I guess I said something about all the wrenching that I had done, and so I gave me credit for some mechanical workshop background.
Uh-huh.
I put my science background. I could maybe pick up on some technical ideas
okay.
a little more readily than a sociology major would say.
Probably. Or so certainly this history major.
And like with so many of us at that time, you were kind of taken from a wide variety of backgrounds, not chosen necessarily for expertise in agriculture.
Uh-huh. Right?
You go there, figure it out, figure out what you're going to do. And we basically kind of, whatever we learned, we kind of had to teach ourselves.
Uh-huh.
We read, we talked to experts. Occasionally I had to organize a seminar of one kind or another. For example, Sabina organizing the latte vegetable seminar. And they invited IDS has brought their cooperatives along. It was a great occasion. She had the experimental station there where she could sort things, and we had information printed out. We had sample seeds and so on. So I thought, yeah, you can go to the seminar.
Yeah.
And we had, that was for basically agronomy, vegetable growing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we had language training over there for the volunteers and a few other
in Vietnam?
In Vietnam, yeah.
Was that good? Because your Vietnamese sounds great. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
You were charming the people in the grocery store when I was picking up
uh-huh.
my sauce here.
The 6 weeks was intensive. It was well done.
It was 6 weeks of language.
Well,
that's good.
And it basically gave me a few grammatical patterns and basic vocabulary for just survival, ordering,
right,
directions,
yeah,
and so on.
Yeah, where's the bathroom?
And it, but most particularly, it allowed us to learn how to pronounce words that we saw and to hear words and put them down so we could use dictionary.
Ah, okay.
So when I finally emerged traumatically from the language program, I've taken, you know, individually by our team leader up to the northernmost province of what was then south, you know, up in the Plum Tree,
mm-hmm,
and sat down there. I was gone from the comfort of my fellow American volunteers to cold turkey out and living entirely on my own, probably the first time in my life. I had to find places where I could eat, had to find places where I could get water because we didn't have water.
Uh-huh.
And just kind of provide all these services after being, you know, dropped off there. I came in the morning. A guy showed me around, introduced me to the aid people, and I think he probably caught the afternoon flight out, and after that, I was in the care of two IVS people, and...
Oh, there were other IVSs up there.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. A few aid people.
Okay.
And there was one Vietnamese chap who knew some other IVSs, and he was my interpreter for a short while.
Uh-huh.
He was very helpful.
Give you a running start.
Right. And then I managed another interpreter,
mm-hmm,
who became a soulmate. And I still correspond with him.
Really?
And I haven't seen him since the summer of 1970. And if I go back next time, I'll look him up. I didn't know whether he's alive or dead until 2 years ago when I went to his village. And did anybody know this guy? And all of a sudden, out of the crowd, and this one-legged woman came over and kind of tattered clothes. And yes, yes, I'm a relative of his. He knew where he is. Yeah, he's in Saigon. Here, come back. I'll give you the address. I went back and got the address, and I wrote and made a connection. And He was very good to me.
Yeah.
He was very good to me.
And
taught language and taught, you know, taught anything. You know, when you're there, everything is new. So
of course.
You can spend endless time in finding what's happening around you. But language, kind of culture. And then I went to meet his family and attended his sister's wedding. His sister's husband, learned, you know, months later, was killed. That's where I was, in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Some of his former students, some of his former classmates were students of the other IVS who came up with me. I wasn't alone as an IVS, but another guy there. Gary Carton, he taught English in the high school.
In Plum Tree, right. Okay.
And,
Plum Tree, right. Okay. I've always heard it Plum Tree or something,
yeah.
Like, yeah, with the obnoxious ang.
Yeah, yeah.
And if I don't hear it pronounced correctly, I have to just assume that whatever I'm hearing is right.
Yeah. And through him and through just living there in Quang Tri, you absorb kind of an atmosphere, an ambience of a very poor piece of Vietnam, which made the people poor, and it made them formidable. Perhaps then the hospital environment, plus their training, plus whatever traditions that I understand, made the Vietnamese in the central region, but they're on the other side. They're very tenacious, very middle fold. The revolutionaries of Vietnam, Dan Van Dam, Ho Chi Minh, all come from the central region, just a few miles north of where we were.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of hard to grab a county.
Yeah, right.
Tough county makes tough people.
Right. Yeah.
That was a local. Like
Harlan County, Kentucky.
Right.
where did the good coal miner strike happen? Right there.
In the winter, you had monsoon for 4 or 5 months, and the sun never shone, and rain most of the time, and the water would come up, and so only the roads stood above, and you sort of what was dry sand became this kind of like a salt pond, or
mm-hmm,
lake on the side. And whenever it rains that long, and it's down in the 40s, it's really left to right. Plus a war going on and people, you know, bodies coming out and, the B-52 attack, the whole thing just made it a real intense downer.
Yeah.
And when the security got very bad, you couldn't even go, you know, across the river. I just evacuated me down to Saigon for a few more days and then I was located down in the Delta. And the Delta...
So how long were you up in Quang Tri?
Probably about 6 months.
And so that was from the massive. First...
From
you,
about
when you first
September,
arrived... Okay,
September 66 until about, April or May 67.
Okay.
Spent a short time in Quang Ngai province, which is another poor province.
Uh-huh.
Area.
That's just the one to the south.
Right. it's south of Da Nang.
Uh-huh.
And then I finally got a permanent assignment down in the Delta. And down in Delta, Vietnam, it's got to be one of the EDs of the whole world.
Okay.
You stand someplace, and even then, you can look to the horizon. And you can't even see the horizon. It's just a sea of green. And it's crisscrossed by a canal.
Yeah.
It was then, it is today, even more so. An era of incredible fertility. And whether it's a connection or whether it's just simply for other reasons, the people in the South, they were more gentle, more easygoing, more open, and everybody, you know, really liked to be down in the Delta. It was just an easygoing place. And I was stationed in a village where I was the only American for about 15 kilometers.
What was the name of the village?
Phu Thom Village in Rich Heart.
Rich Heart.
Rich Heart.
Phu Thom.
Phu Thom.
How much?
Phu?
Phu?
Thom.
Thom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good enough, yeah. Phu Thom Village. And
they're still popular then.
Right. Yeah. And it was unique in many ways. It was rich, as I mentioned.
Yeah.
But,
well, most of the Delta would have been rich. Mm-hmm.
But it remained rich because of the people there who basically worked on in a combination with NLF. You guys come in, the story went, have your R&R, and visit your family, hold your meeting, take your taxes, but don't shoot anything up around here. We're going to go call the other guy.
The Arvin and chase you.
Yeah. And that worked out for a long time. Once there was an accident, and where the local Mieguan, I used to call him Rough Puck, local militia, if you will, was out in his night patrol, kind of had to do that. Usually, as I understood, I know for a fact, just go out somewhere, kind of sit still, make sure you don't bump anything. But they bumped into some NLF, and shots fired, and one guy was killed. And so this good friend of mine took me out, he looked at the body, and says, what a waste. Okay, 2 months ago, one of our guys got shot. Now, their guy got shot. Minus one, plus one. Still zero. Whatever.
Yeah. And the group that did the bumping into the NLF, you call them Rough.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, the rural forces.
Okay.
I think the, RP, it wouldn't be Rough. I forget what it is. It just sort of comes back.
But it's the local militia.
Right, local militia. Everybody from the village and local commander and probably kind of local. Actually, the guy was Cambodian commander.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but just, it was just make a show of it and we know where we go and they know where they go and we just don't bump into each other.
Right. that's the story that came down.
Yeah.
So because of the wealth, because of this accommodation, okay, it enjoyed peace.
Mm-hmm.
I think it enjoyed peace also because, like Hawaii enjoys a certain peace and harmony, because people there are all mixed up. They have first Vietnamese who were there maybe a couple centuries. They had, as I believe, the deserters from the Chinese mercenary army who probably helped one side or another side of the Vietnamese and dynasty fight for control of the country. They were, you know, Chao Chow and the Diu Chow, originally from Fujian province across from Taiwan. And then we had Cambodia. Used to be all Cambodia.
Right.
In the village we had one or two Mahayana Vietnamese wats. And then we had three or four rather larger, more ornate Cambodian Theravada wats.
Mm-hmm.
And you sit in the market and you hear Mui Bipa Purun Brahm, and then you hear Mohai Banya, Iyo Samsu, and the three languages going off. And it was a trip, and people would intermarry. And you see a family, this guy looks really, really Chinese, the mother's really Cambodian, and you look at the kids, and it's just like a, it's like Mendel's peas, and you know, all different varieties and combinations, you know.
That does sound like Hawaii.
White, red, and pink will all be fair, dark, and various shades in between.
Yeah.
And they were friendly, and this and I had a mentor there. A guy kind of kicked me in.
Mm-hmm.
I learned later that it was kind of Confucian to have a superior look after the inferior, to have to not allow anybody to be without family, without friends. And so I think that offer. Also, he was a self-learned man who said two things. Every day I got to learn something new. Every day I have to try and do something good. And so when he saw this Tang Mao, this foreigner, this American there, I was a window to him to the outside world. And so
he would come over and he would ask all these things. Now, in order to ask, he had to teach me a lot of language. And so,
one hand washes the other?
Absolutely. And as he asked me about what happened in the United States, you know, civil rights movement, Kennedy, this whole Kennedy assassination just fascinated him, a lot of
yeah.
me. My mother and my father and my grandparents, everything he could possibly find out. Then so in turn, I would, as I learned more, I'd ask him all these things. He would spend a limited amount of time. He'd come over during, instead of spending siesta, he'd come over and we'd kind of sit there and talk for the heat of the day and then go on our ways. And then he was an acupuncturist, kind of a local acupuncturist, mixture with he did minor surgery and administered antibiotics and so on. Occasionally he invited me to go visit people who were sick around there. But he took me in.
Yeah.
And later, considerable risk. And the risk was, the only way I learned about the risk was after the TED 68 offense had blown over, and I was able to go back to visit.
Well,
how
said,
long were you there?
You say you went back to visit.
I was, let me go back at the crowd. I went down there probably around June or July 1967.
Just after?
And I was there until the TED offense.
And so you were actually there a fairly long time. You were like a year and a half.
Actually, no, it was probably close to half a year or 7 months.
Okay. Wait a minute. I thought it was
from July 66 to about April 67 in Kongtree. From about April to July, sort of between assignments.
Oh, okay.
I was in Kongnai and Saigon.
It was already 67. I thought it was still back in 67.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
So about middle of 67, I was down there in Basrian province.
Uh-huh.
In Phuthon Village, okay, where these things I mentioned.
Yeah.
Okay. And I worked in community development. Okay, let me get that later. But
yeah.
The story.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was in February 1968. Okay. It was a Tet, the year of the monk, a Tet Motan, they say. And the first day of Tet was a very, very merry affair. It was a ceasefire declared between the sides. So we got
right,
on motorcycles.
As in other years.
Right. And we drove the place we couldn't go. We went out to the banks of the Basak River and gate time and all kind of dressed up. And we came back at the afternoon of this first day. And I said, well, gee, I'm really not prepared to do my role at Tet. You have to have goodies in the house. So when people stop by, they wish you knew where you can invite them in. You can treat watermelon soup, candy, beer, what have you. So I better go into town. Okay.
This is used up. It.
Right. Okay. And so I got on my motor scooter. I went into town. It was getting late, so I decided to stay in town and come back the next morning.
Uh-huh.
Well, I stayed in town at the house where two other eyeballs were staying. That's when Tet 68 uncoiled.
Okay.
And it was...
what town was this?
This is in Sopchang City.
Okay.
Bosnian province. The whole city, whole province is now called Sopchang, I believe. But it was, you know, helicopter gunships working. Now we've heard that before. And then we got the roof and said, oh, well, those guys are really clear. And we could see traces going from the ground up towards the gunship. And it wasn't just a little dust up. It lasted all night. And finally in the morning, this Nick Thorne, this American senior advisor in charge of the USAID and MACV, as became known as this advisory effort to the Vietnamese Army, came barreling across the bridge up in his jeep, two guys on each side with guns, riding shotguns, and told us, by this, he had a sense there was something going on.
It was.
We
brought
in his jeep.
It was an invitation. It was an invitation you couldn't refuse.
Right.
Right.
And we went back into the Mackey compound, and then, now that's when began to hear news that happened all around the country.
Uh huh.
And we were never really attacked, but we could see things happen around the city. We could see the planes bombing. If it went like this, tumbled, it was napalm. If it went straight in, it was concussion, and we could. From the napalm, we could see the heat, the density of the air, the wiggles, if you will.
Uh-huh.
We could see the black smoke would follow. We could, we saw the cobras, we saw the gunships. We just saw the whole air war around us. Fortunately for us, and it probably kept us from being overrun, was that right outside Sopchang was the Sopchang Army Base. Okay?
And you were on the
helicopter
other side.
Base. And we had a helicopter station there. So we had real close air support. Now, normally I didn't dig those coppers up there because they did kind of bad things to people on the ground. But I tell you, and everybody was going crazy there. I must admit I was kind of glad to be able to find some place where I didn't have to meet some folks who were all charged up and losing their heads and having to decide, you know, just like anybody else, and
We're not going to sit down and talk and tell stories and find out what a neat guy I was. We're just going to shoot and move on.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he had half a second to make up his mind that he wasn't going to have a conversation.
And we've been here about 2 days, and we get out and walk around and get stuff to dance. And I got pictures in here.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But that was a set of friends for them. And of course, what happened to the rest of the country was well known.
Yeah.
The time it was.
So that made it dangerous for your friend, your mentor, back in the village.
I get back there, okay. And I went back to see him later that summer.
Oh, you stayed away from then on?
I was in South Town, and we evacuated straight to Saigon.
Uh-huh.
Was a little bit safer. We were there just killing time until I was assigned to take a group of incoming volunteers, go to Bosnia and run their orientation. Okay? It was language plus, you know, fluted throughout. It was during the...
Where was this?
We went back to Sop Trang where I was.
Oh, you went back. Okay, all right.
I had a few contacts where we could go see people. But at that time, when we were back there in the summer of 68 now,
So you went out to buy a few things and then disappeared for months.
It was summer of 69, it turns out. Okay.
So that was a... A whole year.
Right, almost a whole year. I went back down there. And I met this guy, and he told me a story. Says that at some point, a friend of mine had been taken out to the countryside and talked to. If you're bad, maybe Lucy will take you out and they'll talk to you. Okay. He came back and told me, this friend of mine, that you better be careful. Okay. They saw you with this American setting off firecrackers the eve of the second day of Tet, even the first day of Tet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe it was because they wanted to see what this American was going to do. This American find out what's going on. Okay. Was he going to go tell what was happening, this impending offensive in France? I didn't have that far yet.
Right.
I was in it.
Yeah.
Okay. And then maybe at the same time that another report came back to his friend that we had all, this friend of mine, but by with other ideas, had all been seen in a restaurant trying, having kind of a banquet with some technicians from Taiwan. This is true.
Yeah.
So what that says is that while I didn't know anybody, they were just going on doing my usual innocent things, that there was the other guys out there keeping track of what was going on.
Yeah.
And when the war is over, okay, the other guys, the VC, the National Liberation Front, or whatever it can be called after liberation.
So you were gone from the second night of the second day of Tet,
and then away for a year later before I could go back and down into this village and meet this gentleman.
Yeah.
And at that time, I found out these instances where I had been closely observed by...
And he had been talked to by VC in the meantime.
In the meantime.
And he's telling you this? That he was talked to?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so it wasn't through a third party.
You know, I'm going to have to hold off, okay? We can't be speaking like this.
Yeah, no. We got to stop meeting like this.
I'd like to help you guys in orientation here a lot more, but I got some heat. And then when it was all over, as I started to say, in 1975, he got some severe heat to use in re-education.
For 3 years.
For 3 years.
Uh-huh.
And part
just for knowing you?
That, and I also think that some other things he did where he may have engendered some private grudges, and then when you have a program around up people who, for other reasons, for being less than faithful to the new regime, then you can toss in private grudges and probably he is when he went back this time, he stopped by people who were fabricating things and pinning on him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
once you're a target, then anyone can throw more stuff.
His one son was able to get out in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
Another son and a daughter were detained. They tried to escape. The son was shot, killed, and escaped. The daughter had to spend, I don't know how many more years in re-education. His youngest son, I think, spent something like from age 14 to age 21 or something like that. He really had a long spirit.
Mm-hmm. That was tough. Very, very tough.
I kind of had to listen to what they said. I didn't try to probe that too much. It just probably wasn't a real happy topic. Although the son who said I was there at 14, he was kind of laughing. I was there, you know, from age 14 to 21. Man, it kept me a long time. He could laugh about it, but I'm sure it was bitter, and
yeah,
I just kind of listened at that point, and that poked a lot, as interesting as it would be.
Yeah, yeah, it's something you want to stay away from.
But anyway, that shows...
This is on a return trip. When did you go back?
Okay, I went back in 93.
In 93, yeah, that's okay.
Where I began to get some of the information.
I think you said that over the phone the other night.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you going to go back again?
I hope. I'm just so frustrated I can't go to China.
Yeah.
And I just got, I mean, my mind is so much over there in the course of my daily life. I mean, things that are interesting are still over there.
Yeah.
And I just may just go on over there to meet people who met a long time ago, to see a country in transition,
mm-hmm.
how much you can see in two weeks,
yeah.
or nothing. And but also to try to find contacts. I'm talking about teachers and maybe a school in the south, school to the south, maybe a school in Hue, a school in Hanoi, where I could conceivably arrange to bring groups of students over there, and they'd have schools to visit and
yeah.
people they could meet with, and they can go play soccer or volleyball or crook or whatever, and thus, in some small measure, okay, have this cross-cultural experience, particularly in a place with some bitter history behind, and that if they have any appreciation what before, they can see that how the younger generation can put it aside and just start afresh. I found
yeah.
that very refreshing when I was over there. I met some kids in 93. I was in the Chinese district called Jalan, and my nephew, who was in Cambodia for a couple of years, speaks fluent Cambodian, learned Vietnamese in San Jose, California. We were traveling together, and we were having dinner, and these kids come along in their white shirts, which identify them as students, and they study some English and anxious to practice on them. And they said, hi, how are you, where are you from, the usual questions, and I was feeling confident, so I started going out in Vietnamese, and I started to say, well, where's some imperialist Americans just coming back from a visit? And he said, oh no, please don't say that, please don't use the language. And they were offended, okay, that I would bring up anything related, even in a joking way, to how Americans are once viewed, sort of self-deprecating
mm-hmm.
humor. And they were put off by that. Okay?
Uh-huh.
And they said, oh, that's a long time ago, no problem. They just, I mean, we, you know, they weren't wearing the history on their shirt. Okay? They were there, here these people, curious, we knew some English, and they were perfectly okay by us.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to speak for the way most people were. Okay? And I found that amazing. And here's those come stories I've been always saving for this opportunity. How could the Vietnamese, who had that long and awful war down in the heads, which we brought to them as Americans, while I was there, and less surprisingly later on, how could they see me and a lot of other IDSers as individuals separate from the rest of the Americans and evaluate us as individuals? And generally we listened a lot and we wanted to get along, and we did, each of us will have these stories, I'm sure, as you go and interview people. Okay? And there's some attitudes that I met over and over again. One, okay, the Vietnamese were taught, and I'll tell you who taught them a little bit later, were taught to distinguish between Americans who were actually culpable,
mm-hmm.
President Johnson,
yeah.
Nixon, Senator, you know, this, that, the names, you know, fading me right now, I could get them in a minute or two. The board of directors of Rand Corporation, of Dow Chemical, of, you know, all the people there who profited from the war, the higher military officials, you know, colonels and above and so on, lifers. They knew these guys were responsible, and they didn't share much aloha for these guys. They caused Vietnam a lot of agony. They also recognized that along with these Americans are those who were sucked up into this whole war, much against their will.
The soldiers.
Okay? The soldiers over there, like myself. And for, again, having all that happened to them, and it happened while I was there, for them to be able to make that distinction. And with that distinction, they just take their time in meeting me and giving me their time and their help in learning language, help in learning history, and all these other things. And, you know, I would say I probably had, you know, a good number of mentors. I found very light. How many Americans over there could tell one group from another, or would even bother to tell one group from another, that these are all people, and all they're the the flag of the Republic of Vietnam was very symbolic. It was yellow with stripes of red down the back. Now, that was a metaphor for many Americans. And they, you know, all of Vietnamese, River Goog, Slope Stinks, and so on. You've heard those before. So that was impressive. Another metaphor I heard, well, not one was kind of an outlook, this is a metaphor. I heard a couple of times. Again, it was during the war, and it was this. Okay? The men are basically the same. Each has kind of a core of humanity, a core of divinity. That's the same no matter whether you're Muslim or Black African or Arabian or Indian or New Guinean or what have you. Okay? But this core of humanity is kind of like a light inside of a lantern. And this light shines in all directions. If it shines through a red prism, okay, maybe that would be, I'll just pick a country, maybe that'd be Muslims, okay, or Arabs. If it shines through a green prism, maybe that should be the Arab one, okay. If it shines through a blue prism, that would be, let's say, the Americans and so on, okay. If it shines through yet another color, it'd be yet another people. You know, there's this communist all mankind, they knew all basically decent, and by inference, give everybody certain minimum babble, being willing to listen to them. And mm-hmm. So I benefit from that. You know. I was okay. I was human.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how many Americans over there would give it me?
Yeah.
Would give the Vietnamese that same basic status.
Yeah. Yeah. Very. Almost nobody.
Yeah. Yeah. And I respect the Vietnamese for those particular outlooks. Now, where did this idea that to distinguish between good Americans and bad Americans and so on, those actually responsible and those who were sucked up, mm-hmm. Like the Vietnamese themselves, were victims?
Mm-hmm.
I finally got a chance in near Halong Bay, which is a very beautiful scenic spot off the course of North Vietnam, where they have these karst to stick up out of the water, like mm-hmm. the coils of a descending
right.
dragon. The movie
right.
Indochine, you see that?
Yes.
Okay. I went down there, so beautiful, I had to see it, I had to go down there. So I went, and we got to talking, and I explained this viewpoint, which I thought was amazing. And I asked, where'd you get that point of view? He said, Bak Ho Yai, Uncle Ho taught us. That's premature realpolitik.
Mm-hmm.
Mature thinking anybody's level.
Yeah. Wow.
So, those are some of my nuggets there.
No, those really are nuggets, and it did make, in a sense, their side more humane and more able to go the long haul.
And because of these things I heard, and because if you look at all of violence, it seemed to have a pattern. It seemed, for the most part, to be not random violence, but aimed